Hi there, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just spoke with Catherine Jamy, who joined me via Skype from Paris, about her new book, The Emperor's New Mathematics, Western Learning and Imperial Authority During the Kangxi Reign, 1662 to 1722. And that was just published very recently in 2012 with the Oxford University Press. Now, this is a book that is extraordinarily rich. It's full of really detailed analyses of a very exceptionally important period in the history of science and in the history of China. This is science at the Kangxi court, and mathematics in particular. It's a book that is not only, so rich that we probably only got to about half of it in the course of our conversation, but it's also very rich in terms of the methodological contributions that it's making to a broader dialogue about the history of science in and with global history. Jamy and her analysis asks us to really rethink or in some ways get rid of our ideas of the dichotomies between China and Europe in the history of science. She asks us to rethink the importance of circulation in producing knowledge, not just in sort of moving already existing knowledge around. It's a very interesting book. It's a very important book, certainly for anybody interested in the history of science and its relationship to Chinese history. And it's also a very enjoyable book to read. We had a great time talking, or certainly I did, and I hope that you enjoy. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Catherine Jamy about her book, The Emperor's New Mathematics, Western Learning and Imperial Authority During the Kangxi Reign, 1662 to 1722. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Catherine, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Could you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the history of science in China and to the history of mathematics in particular?
I'm afraid this is not really an intellectual trajectory. It just happened that as a child, I had the opportunity to study Chinese at school from the age of 11. This was in the days where, when because of the Cultural Revolution, you could never meet a real native speaker of Chinese. It took me 6 years of study before I could actually talk to someone in someone whose native language was Chinese. And then I started off to be a mathematician. I became curious of, how things had been invented rather than just learning so-and-so's theorem ready-made. And eventually I started putting my two, I would say, subjects of curiosity together. And also I felt interested in knowing how, things traveled between Europe and China. So this is really how I came to this field, not really very much knowing about what history of science was, because in those days in France, this was the 1980s, it wasn't very easy for someone like me with a degree in pure mathematics to, there was no department. And typically in France, you would become a historian of science more as a philosopher. Somehow I made all my interests link together, and that's how I started.
That's great. Thank you. Now, this book is coming out at a point where you've already got a very long and very accomplished career of publishing in the history of Chinese science, in the history of Chinese mathematics. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of this book project in particular and sort of where this fits within the larger scope of your work?
Mm-hmm. So I started by working on the reception of what is called Western learning in China by exploring the work of an 18th century mathematician and astronomer. And then, as historians usually do, I sort of went backward, and this mathematician's training really seemed to be very closely related with the Imperial Compendium of Mathematics, which the present book is devoted to. And as I also started to work more, I started focusing on the Jesuits in early Qing China, I kept running into the Kangxi Emperor. And, you know, although originally I was more interested in looking at what less important or famous people had done, I had to admit in the end that I couldn't really get away from him. I couldn't really, you know, I really had to focus on to understand how important and how significant he was. Then I should mention I had a chance to work in China in collaboration with Han Xi from the Institute for the History of Natural Science. And we uncovered some manuscripts together. And after we'd sort of done a bit of work, he was ahead of me in that, but then we joined forces. And when we had published together, I realized that there was a lot more to say, that one had to really reconstruct the story of these manuscripts, but not so much of the manuscript, but I was more interested in the actors and how it is that something that is labeled Western can be turned into something that is called imperial and therefore become in principle a must for Orthodox scholars to be involved in. So that's really how things started. I think between the time when I realized, well, I must have a book to write here, and the time when the book was published, it took 10 years. There is also another aspect to the genesis of the book. It was the realization that there was, I would say, there was a need to write the history of Western learning in China as regards mathematics by focusing on something that had been completely neglected, because usually Western mathematics in China, it was, you know, Euclid in China. That is actually the title of a very good book published in 1998 by Peter Engelfried. So Euclid is wonderful. It's the Greek classic. It wasn't there before, and suddenly it's translated. And so it's a kind of, I would say, a cliche of, you know, what is strikingly new, what cannot be disputed is relevant that the Jesuits brought to China. And it seemed to me that it was interesting to look at another field which was perceived as complementary to that at the time, which was calculation. And there, when one looks at the picture, it's much more complex, because it's much more a matter of negotiating between traditions that are already there in China and some aspects of what the Jesuits bring in. And the various material from the late Ming to early Qing showed that one could also do this by following very much the way one does when analyzing a tradition, the various ways in which a particular mathematical problem was dealt with in a succession of mathematical texts between late 16th and early 18th century. So that was really the two aspects. That is, you know, I would say a story very much about the actors, and also looking, following mainly one particular thread as to the mathematics I discuss in the book, because of course I do not cover the whole field of mathematics.
Yeah. So the book itself looks closely at science in the imperial context of the reign of the emperor who you just mentioned, the Kangxi Emperor, who, for listeners who might be unfamiliar with this period of Chinese history, reigned from 1662 to 1722. Now, it focuses on the history of mathematics in this context, as you mentioned, but it situates the story of mathematics in Kangxi within a larger framework, extending from the late Ming through the years after Kangxi's reign, and treating actually much much more than mathematics in the course of the analysis, I think very helpfully. Now, let's start off by speaking a little bit to something that I think you talked a little bit about when situating the genesis of this particular project within its larger context. The book is very careful to place this story of Kangxi and of mathematics within a larger framework of the circulation of science in a global context. And what you just mentioned in terms of a kind of methodology of following a problem, a mathematical problem, as an object as it circulates both from place to place and across text is actually very interesting. How does the account of the circulation of science that you want to present in this book and that you did present in this book differ methodologically from what you might characterize as, or what we might think of as, a conventional story about China and the history of science? So what methodological contributions to the story of the circulation of science as it involves China were you hoping to accomplish with the book?
I think the first assumption I wanted to challenge was that it has any meaning to talk about China and Europe or China and the West as two entities. I have become convinced while working on that book that circulation, there is no, I mean, circulation, I would say, within a society, that for example of the early Qing, can be treated basically, can be approached in a way similar to circulations, not only within Europe, but also between Europe and China, that in fact one has tended very much to essentialize, to see two entities, whether there would be encountering, confronting. I mean, you find lots of nice verbs to describe what happens there. But that in fact, if you start looking at things closely, the modalities either a whole body of knowledge or some elements of it can circulate, the analysis needs to look at, I would say, at, on, if we say on each side, if we count the sides up as the languages the sources are written in, for example, for any given Jesuit who worked in China, you need to look at his personal trajectory, what colleges he studied, where he studied, what books he read, and things like that, what languages he functioned in. And also on the other side, one finds, for example, that in several cases, the Imperial Palace was a dead end, that knowledge that had been circulated and then translated up to there all the way from Europe, stayed within, literally or metaphorically speaking, the walls of the Forbidden City. And that's the case, for example, of this famous treatise on anatomy. So one needed to understand, I think, very much within the early Qing society, the balance of power between at different times between the emperor, Chinese officials, also Manchu officials and members of the imperial household. So for me, that the main points about circulation is that you have to break any idea of dichotomy. It is always a story with several actors, and the oppositions and the alliances are not always according to whether one is supposed to be Chinese or Western. Because, of course, one of the questions behind this is, was the Emperor of China Chinese at the time? And as all the students of Qing China know, he was not, and he did not regard himself as Chinese, but as Manchu. And that, I think, has a lot of bearing on the fate of Western learning in China. So for me, that is the that was one of the main points that I found it important to make in that book. Another point regarding methodology is that I am no longer sure that it makes much sense to distinguish between circulation and production of knowledge. That if, as you know, knowledge is constructed, it rarely can remain located within the main the same geographical or social location, and that conversely, by moving from one place or one group to another, it needs to be rewritten, interpreted in different ways, so that in a sense, one, I think, should not consider the study of circulation as different from that of construction and or knowledge production. It may be less obvious in mathematics than it is, for example, in another field that was very important at the time at both ends of the Eurasian continent, that is cartography. Which was also a major concern both of some of the Jesuits who were in China and of the Emperor of China. So for me, probably these are the two main points that I wanted to make and to illustrate in my book.
Great. And I think the book does both of those things exceptionally well. And another thing that you mentioned, reminding us that Kangxi Emperor was Manchu, not Chinese, is just... That's part of, I think, a larger situation of the story that you give us within something that you call a New Qing history, right? Which is also exceptionally important. And I think, I hope that we see many, many more works such as this along those lines. It's very, very useful in putting this story about the history of science as you do within a larger historical context. Now, the book is broken up into several parts, and part one of the book gives us a kind of necessary historical background to understand how to get to the point of Kangxi and where we are once we get there. So it sort of sets up the story of that we'll look at later on in the Qing. The first chapter looks at the beginnings of Western learning in China at the end of the Ming Dynasty. And this is important for listeners who aren't familiar with this context so much, because one of the things that happens in the course of this book in the history of mathematics in China is that we have a transformation from one dynasty to another. So we start in the late Ming. Now, this chapter looks at the Jesuits' teaching of mathematics in China during that period and the translations that they helped produce, including this rendering into Chinese of the first six books of Euclid's Elements, and this is probably what we were talking about earlier before. Now, because this chapter raises a theme that's going to continue to be very important later on in this book, and certainly when we get to Kangxi, and that's actually quite interesting in the larger context of the history of science, and that is the pedagogy of science. So I want to ask you, if you could, to talk a little bit about this in this context. The pedagogy of mathematics becomes a very important theme throughout this book, albeit in different contexts. Can you talk a little bit about the major factors that were influencing the way Jesuits in this period in the late Ming, including Matteo Ricci, were teaching mathematics in China? So what was the pedagogy of mathematics by Jesuits in China at this period in the late Ming? And so that we can sort of have a context to compare what's going to happen in the teaching of mathematics in China later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the point that in the end seemed the most significant to me was that the Jesuits needed to find a niche amongst Chinese literati. You know, they decided to identify themselves to that particular social group rather than to Buddhist monks, as they had begun by doing. And in order to do that, I think they reinterpreted a role they were familiar with in Europe, which was that of teachers. At the time, so we are talking about the very end of the 16th century and the first decade of the 17th century, the Society of Jesus had built up the most important educational network in Europe. What we find the Jesuits doing is, usually one says translating, publishing, but in fact, teaching some of the subjects that are taught in colleges in Europe to a number of literati, some of which are converts at the time when they are taught or later become converts, but others are simply interested or curious and do not actually become Christian. But it's very clear from, if we take the first and probably most famous Jesuit missionary in China, Matteo Ricci. Matteo Ricci arrived in China in 1582. And he was a student of Christoph Clavius, most famous as the author of the Gregorian calendar. And Matteo Ricci simply started to relate to some literati by transmitting to them what he had learned from his master at the Roman College, having found that there was more interest in subjects like mathematics, geography, or some technical subjects than there was in Aristotelian philosophy or even in subjects like logic or matters more directly related to the Catholic religion. So the Jesuit as a teacher is the way the Jesuit becomes part of the literati class. And so if we look at more closely of, you know, how things were done, it does not seem that there was any structure similar to what there could be in Europe, that is a classroom. We have no evidence of more than one person being taught at the same time, which, of course, I mean, maybe it happened. But, for example, if we look at the translation of Euclid's Elements, the first six books, into Chinese, Ricci describes it as the outcome of his teaching of mathematics to Xu Guangqi. So, in a way that's, you know, very much modeled on what happened in Europe. There were no textbooks available to everyone in Jesuit colleges. Books were more for the master, and the students would take notes, and the notes would be, the lecture that the master had dictated. So Ricci effectively dictated his course on Euclidean geometry, which was really the most significant part of Clavius's Latin of Latin version of Euclid, and successful Chinese version, we have, in a sense, a token of Ricci's success as a teacher and Xu Guangqi's achievement as a student. And for all we know, the translations into Chinese that happened in the late Ming in mathematics, but also in some other technical subjects, were done in the same way. And the Chinese phrase used on the first page of many of these books says that it was transmitted orally and collected and received in writing. So this was the what we call a collaboration for translation was a pedagogical relationship.
Now, the Jesuits, other Jesuits, worked on astronomical reform from 1629 until the fall of the Ming in 1644, and two Jesuits appointed to work on the reform after a proposal by Xu Guangqi were Johann Schreck and Johann Adam Schall von Bell. And Schall von Bell, this he becomes an important figure later on in the next chapter. Now, he was the only Jesuit in Beijing when it fell to Li Zicheng, and this heralds the changing over of the dynasty. And this brings us into the next chapter. Can you talk a little bit about... So the next chapter situates us in the Qing. Can you talk a bit about how this dynastic change impacted Jesuit opportunities in Beijing?
So what the story one has of the transition in Beijing, so in 1644 was that when the Manchus took Beijing, which was previously occupied by Li Zicheng, so the previous dynastic order had already collapsed. There were a number of eminent residents of Beijing who offered their services to the Manchus, who were perceived as reestablishing order after the rather bloody episode of Li Zicheng. And the story is that Adam Shaw then offered them the calendars that he had had prepared for the Ming. And so there was a direct offer of service to the new dynasty, which was accepted, and in exchange for which Adam Shaw then, became a civil servant. And so the change is that rather than being under the patronage of Chinese literati officials, the Jesuits, or at least one of them, because I don't think there was ever more than one Jesuit official astronomer at a time. So Adam Shaw himself becomes a civil servant in a position that we should say is not a very a prominent one. Astronomers did not go through the path of imperial examinations, and so they were not, in principle, politically very powerful. However, Charles was, I would say, amongst the resources that the Manchus found available in Beijing. And of course, it was an important one because in the Chinese imperial tradition, a good calendar is a token of dynastic legitimacy. In that the emperor, being the intermediary between heaven and earth, has to be the one who makes sure that human society lives in harmony with the rhythms of the cosmos. So this is what Adam Shaw was effectively offering to the Manchus. So interestingly, this made him very close to imperial power, because he did not only become a civil servant, but he effectively became someone who entered the imperial household. And from then on, we have this dual position of the Jesuits in the Chinese civil service, but also in the imperial household that was mainly staffed by Manchus, in fact, or bannermen, I should say, because not all the conquest elite was Manchu. A number of them were Mongol and Chinese.
Great. Now, this sort of, after introducing this, the next section of the book moves us into the first two decades of Kangxi's personal rule from 1669 to 1689. One of the things that happens upon the assumption of power by Kangxi is that Ferdinand Verbeest becomes the official astronomer, and then ultimately he becomes Kangxi's tutor as the ruler becomes interested in Western science, and this really gets us into a very exciting part of this story. Can you talk a little bit about the context of this tutelage of Kangxi? We've already sort of set the stage earlier in our conversation by sort of mentioning the importance of pedagogy of mathematics earlier in the period. When Verbeest is tutoring Kangxi in science and in mathematics, what does that tutoring consist of? Can you talk about that a little bit?
So all the detailed accounts we have of Jesuit tutoring to the emperor come they all come from the Jesuit side, because I mentioned the imperial household, they were servants and were not very important. So this means we have a very one-sided view. But even then, we know that the reason why the emperor decided to become to become competent in these subjects is because he found out that whereas astronomy had such an important cosmological and political role, there was no one around him, neither the Chinese nor the Manchu officials, who really understood it. And so, very typically of the Kangxi Emperor in old fields, he decided he was going to get a direct grasp and control of it. I think one interesting characteristic of the teaching of Verbiest as we know it, and also of Verbiest successors on which we know more, is that there is a constant negotiation between what the Jesuits find is important to study and what the emperor has the time to study, is interested in, and so on and so forth. So we know that, for example, Verbiest starts with Euclid elements and starts translating it into Manchu. But clearly, Kangxi prefers applied geometry, and quite interested, although he insists that he wants to understand everything. And it seems that at least at the time when he studies, it is not just a case of, Scipio Curtius complimenting his majesty. There is some evidence that the emperor didn't understand what he was studying. But what is very striking is that in contrast with late Ming scholars, we are not in a situation where the tutors can tell the student what he has to learn. There is also a negotiation as to what is relevant. And we find, for example, that at a time when Verbiest supervised the making of canon, at the time of the three feudatory rebellions, so in the 1670s, this is when Kangxi suddenly said, I want to know more geometry, but he was also interested in ballistics. So there are always very narrow links between what is studied and the political needs or military needs in that case of the emperor at a given time. I think it's a very interesting fact that the emperor never seems to study because he's interested or because he wants to. He always stages what he's doing as part of his duty as the emperor of China.
Now, you mentioned then that Verbiest also worked on a canon, and this actually brings me to something that's very, I think, really wonderful about the book and very notable about the book, and this is the ways that throughout the book you're constantly reminding us of the importance of the negotiation by all of these actors, not just of ideas and texts, but also of material objects. So among the many tasks that Verbiest is charged with, he's charged with updating the instruments at the Astronomical Bureau. Now, this brings out, as I mentioned, that just the crucial importance to this story of materiality and material objects and instruments in the history of mathematics at the Kangxi court. This is something that recurs throughout the book, and it seems like not just something that is for the reader quite a useful intervention and an important point, but it also seems very important to the work that you were trying to do in the book, if I can gather that from my reading. Can you talk a little bit about that, sort of about the importance of materiality and objects and instruments to the story that you're telling? If I'm reading that correctly, if I'm at all right in assuming.
No, you certainly are reading that correctly. I think I am trying to, I would say, in a sense, try to go beyond the limits of what, you know, what one is used to in talking about the history of mathematics. Mathematics is supposed to be, you know, basically texts that has in it, okay, methods, concepts, and things that are very abstract. But this is, of course, not always historically the case. And one is bound to find, I think, if one looked at mathematical sciences at the same time in other parts of the world, especially in a context where it's sponsored by a sovereign, one would always, I think, find it related to very material concerns. And yes, objects were important. One should also say that the word mathematics at the time included much more than it does today, and that the Jesuits, for example, considered astronomy as part of mathematics. And when you read the sources, they do not say they're working at the Astronomical Bureau. They say they're working at the Tribunal of Mathematics. So there is also, one also has to interpret mathematics, you know, as a term that varies historically. This will be, you know, evident to historians of mathematics, but it does not follow that history of mathematics always takes this into account. And what really forced me to take this into account is the I think the accounts we have of the emperor's practice of mathematics, you know, when he's learning about proportions and how the volume of a sphere and its weight are proportional to one another, because he's the emperor, he can have various spheres made of metal, wood, etc., of various sizes to check experimentally that this is correct. A more ordinary student would just have to believe his teacher. So in the very process of learning, I would say objects matter very much. And then, of course, instruments, whether they are made for calculation or for surveying, are at that time, I think, an essential part of the mathematical activity around the world. In my story, I think you're quite right in pointing out that knowledge can be sort of, you know, materialized as books, texts, but it can also be materialized as instruments. And in negotiating patronage, both aspects are of great importance. And it is also important, I think, to understand that the science tutors of the emperor, the Jesuits, are also the same who were employed to for the maintenance of instruments, because it gives a profile of the range of expertise that is understood under the term of mathematics or mathematical sciences at a particular time and place. And I think at that time, certainly in more than one place.
Right. Now, another way in which this sort of, we can see this active negotiation in this story among different instruments of calculation, and those instruments being an object like an abacus, but also an instrument like a written calculation, comes in the character or the actor of Mei Wending, who is the main character of the next chapter. Now, Mei Wending is going to continue to be important later in the book and later in the story, and he rose to prominence in this period. Can you speak a little bit to who he is? Can you introduce him a little bit for our listeners? And in part, I'm bringing this up because the fact that we focus on him in this chapter, I think, really reminds us as readers as we work through the book that this isn't just a story about the Jesuits and Kangxi, right? That this is really a story about a lot of different kinds of actors co-creating this mathematical knowledge at the point. And so Mei Wending winds up being very important, and very important later on increasingly in a transformation that we see in power. At court of when we look at who's actually doing mathematics, that is in this official context. So that's a long way of setting up the introductory question. Can you talk a little bit about Mei Wending and how he's important to this story at this point?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mei Wending is regarded nowadays as the greatest mathematician and astronomer of this whole period. If you look at him when he lived, though, he was first a literatus from a small town in Anhui. Actually, he was not a town person. He lived in the countryside, and came from a family of the local gentry, in which it seems to have been a kind of family hobby, family interest, to look at the stars at night. And I think this was not as uncommon as what one may think. There was generally a lot more widespread knowledge of the night sky probably in all parts of the world in those days than in ours. So anyhow, Mei Wending appears as not a mathematician, because the profession did not exist as such, but rather a scholar who specializes in the mathematical sciences. And his career is one of, I would say, striving for recognition, attempts to have his work published, which only, I think, succeeds when he's already in his 70s. And interestingly also, if you look at Mei Wending's biography from the point of view of his itinerary, so he starts from his hometown, he passes the first examination locally, and then when in the 1670s he goes to Nanjing to take the provincial examination, also very typically of what was the case for the circulation of knowledge, it is in Nanjing that he has access to books he has heard of but never seen before, to books he didn't know existed. And this is done apparently not only by purchasing books, but by going to libraries and copying books. So this is how, also where we see how specialized knowledge that, you know, could be certainly about the classics, about technical subjects, about agriculture, but also about mathematics, could be exchanged amongst literati. And certainly in Nanjing, he meets other people who are interested in the same field. He begins to have a reputation. His reputation is really constructed, you know, from his native prefecture to Nanjing, and then from Nanjing to Beijing. He's a very prolific writer. Already in the 1670s, he has written at least about 10 mathematical treatises and some books on astronomy. Eventually, he gets invited to the capital because in relation to the project of compiling the dynastic history of the Ming that the Kangxi Emperor has launched. Dynastic histories in China always had chapters on the calendar, and so he is asked to work on these. So this is how he makes a name also in the capital. If we look at Mei Wending from the point of view of what he knew and what he was interested in, clearly the first knowledge he has was from Chinese traditional works, and it's gradually that he becomes interested in Western knowledge and you know, has access to it. And his position on this I would say, on the one hand, he thinks that there is not much point in distinguishing between Chinese and Western, that mathematics is one, East and West, and one should all put it together in a synthetic way, choosing in each tradition what is most relevant. So that's, I think, the way he works on mathematics. However, when he comes to talking about mathematics and astronomy, his discourse is slightly different, and gradually he builds up the argument that there is not much that is new in what the Jesuits are bringing, and that all Western knowledge originates in China. And this idea is actually extremely influential, and it remains there in China until the 19th century, basically. So it's on the one hand, you could say it's denying the you know, the value of the Jesuits' contribution, but it is also providing a rationale to adopt this knowledge, because if it's all Chinese in the first place, if one is just retrieving ancient knowledge that is lost, there is no question that studying all this and promoting it is a perfectly orthodox thing to do.
Great. Thank you. Now, after we meet Mei Wending, what the next sections of the book show us is this large arc whereby, on the one hand, Kangxi is sort of showing off and using these lessons, the knowledge that he gained with lessons with the Jesuits, in order to assert his authority over distinguished scholar officials, and then in the next section of the book, turning around and reversing this dismissal of Chinese scholars' knowledge of mathematics, and sort of really changing the face of what mathematics looks like at the court. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because I don't want to take up 3 hours of your time, although there is that much richness in the book and we could talk for that long. But let's move toward the next section of the book. Now, at this point, in the late 17th century, at this point, new actors start coming into the story and really challenging the preeminence of these Jesuits that we've been talking about. And you take us through this sort of, I think, really wonderfully, a kind of typical study session or a typical lesson that Kangxi would have had with two French Jesuits in particular, Gerbillon and Bouvet, who were tutoring him in not just mathematics, but also materia medica and anatomy and so on and so forth. Now, one of the things that come, and there's a ton in there that we could talk about that I'll just gesture at for listeners. It's an extraordinarily rich section of the book. Now, one of the things that you mention here, that you kind of underline for us, is the role of language as one of the larger themes of this chapter of the history of science globally, really. The language of science and Kangxi's scientific education plays a really important role in this central part of the book. Now, you bring us to, in chapter 8, this textbook, this New Elements of Geometry, which is actually first translated from French into Manchu, and then Manchu into Chinese. And I think one of the things that this does for listeners is to really sort of bring out the importance of Manchu for the history of science. Can you talk a little bit to that issue? How important is understanding the role, or how important is Manchu language here to the way the story unfolds?
I think, yes, there's the particular case of geometry is a very good summary of what the Kangxi Emperor sought to achieve. Because what we are saying here is that geometry is no longer coming from Latin into Chinese, it's coming from the Manchus. Imperial geometry comes from the Manchu, from Manchu into Chinese. which of course is a it's crucial because what is happening at that time, Kangxi is having all the Chinese classics. In the Manchu language. So I think he used the sciences and mathematics in particular as a kind of counterexample. In a sense, he was trying to make the balance a bit more even and trying to display the fact that Manchu, the language Manchu, could also be the vehicle of something that Chinese needed and did not have available to them, or unless the Qing gave it to them. So I think this is quite an important. It's quite an important reason for him to have his mathematics lessons in Manchu at a time when it seems that he was perfectly comfortable and fluent in Chinese.
Thank you. Now, the sort of as you take us through this part of the book, you take us through cases that I'll just mention without going into detail, a case in which you show us lecture notes by one of his tutors, in fact, the most prolific Jesuit mathematician at court, and the sort of the ways that those lecture notes get adapted into a textbook. You take us back to Mei Wending, and then we sort of get to this point in the 1700s where Kangxi is ending, or he's sort of looking toward the end of his reign. The issue of his succession is looming, and he begins to distance himself from the Jesuits he's been working with, and really change direction and start focusing more on Chinese scholars and bannermen as his imperial mathematicians. Can you speak a little bit to that? Why does he begin distancing himself from the Jesuits and from his tutors, and what happens to push him in this different direction?
Important reason for that was what is seen from Europe as an episode in the rights controversy. That is when a papal legate comes to the Beijing court and basically tells the emperor that Chinese Christians are not allowed to do ancestor worship, like, you know, imagine a Buddhist monk coming to Louis XIV and telling him that some of his subjects won't attend mass anymore. If you try to imagine that, you realize how mild the imperial reaction was at that stage. I think that the challenge to Confucian orthodoxy was such that no matter how he felt, because we don't really know how the emperor felt. He had a great talent for addressing his various subjects in such a way that each of them would feel, sympathy or whenever it was necessary. So we do not often have evidence that the emperor really genuinely believed something, but in a sense, this is not what the story is about, and I think no good politician, it's not what you want to study. But in any case, there is a perception that missions can be a threat because they are spreading, especially in Jiangnan, so the lower Yangtze region, without much control. And so this is one reason why the emperor seems to distance himself from the Jesuits. But it does not mean he stops using them. It means he then turns to some Chinese scholars, beginning with Mei Wending, and starts looking for mathematical talent amongst them. I think there is one stake there that is important. It's that of monopoly. Kangxi had so far retained a complete monopoly of on the Jesuits' teachings, and the reversal of alliance results in the fact that he's now ready to share it. And of course, being the emperor, he's sharing it by turning himself into a teacher in the Confucian mode.
Now, as we move into the conclusion of the book, before we wrap up, there's just a couple of things that I'd love to hear you talk about a little bit. So as we move into these last two sections, and certainly the last one, we see Kangxi creating an office of mathematics staffed by Chinese scholars and bannermen, and we see the major project that they're working on, which is the compilation of this text that you began talking about. And this is a text that you translate here as The Essence of Numbers and Their Principles. Now, most of the content of this massive treatise was derived from Jesuits' lecture notes, but that content was reworked within a structure of a different system of mathematics. Can you talk, because that this text is so important in the context of this book, can you talk a little bit about this text and the ways that it was different from and reworked these notes that it was based on, at least in part?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first major point is that the lecture notes were separate textbooks. Sometimes they were cross references, but they were not just one work. So there was no claim as to the overarching structure of mathematics that can be drawn from these textbooks. Whereas the Essence of Numbers of and Their Principles does make such a claim, and so that's one aspect, and the other aspect is the very detailed rewriting of, for example, the problems themselves, or the rewriting of the geometry treatise that had been translated from Manchu. So clearly, the text is turned into a text that is more, I would say, up to literati standards. And it also, in many cases, going towards a greater concision. Some of the Jesuit lecture notes give the impression that we have in the text every single step that the teacher has made to his student. Whereas the there is a I would say a more the Essence of Numbers and Their Principles is closer to the mathematical tradition, perhaps in greater concision, for example, for each part, then yes, there is the overarching structure of mathematics is basically first the assertion of the foundations of mathematics as being the same as their historical origins. So going back to some knowledge ascribed to high antiquity. Then after that, we have elements of geometry and of calculations. And then the second and by far the largest section of the treatise will be applying what we have in these elements. And everything is then organized according to dimensions, or first just calculation, but then everything that has, you know, one dimensional, so everything that is lines in geometry and linear equations, and then after lines you have areas, and then you have solids. So the something that is basically a classification that has to do with that of geometrical objects is used to structure mathematics at large.
Now, As we come to a close here, I just also want to kind of point out for listeners that there's a fascinating chapter on what you call methods and material culture in this treatise that looks at the importance of the material culture of mathematical problems found in the treatise, which also reminds us again of the importance of materials and objects. I mean, things like inks, not just inkstones and diamonds, but also weighing scales that I think is fruit for much thought and much sort of thoughtful reflection. And I think that was really, really helpful, at least for me, to read about that chapter. Now, as the book closes, you bring us into the end of the story, or at least the end of this story, with the way things change with the death of Kangxi. And then in the conclusion, you also leave us with, I think, some really helpful thoughts about the possible broader implications of this study for the field of history of science, and in terms of its comparative and also global aspects. So as we close, or before I ask you my super closing questions, is there anything that you'd like to sort of mention about these broader implications for you thinking about this work? We've talked about the importance of your kind of destabilizing these dichotomies of Europe and China. We've talked about the importance of thinking about circulation as a way of producing knowledge, not just as sort of moving already solid, you know, unchanging knowledge around. What other implications does this study have for their broader understanding of history of science, especially in a global context, and perhaps especially in the early modern world?
I
know, it's a very small question, right?
It's a very small question, perhaps. Could be just as concise and suggest that, you know, the readers might find out. But I think perhaps what I have, what I've tried to do in closing is partly to say, well, you know, this is just one little story in you know, the what there is to say of on the history of science, not the global history of science, but the history of science looked and, you know, connected, I would say, in different parts of the world. And you know, what also why I tried to come back to what my story can mean in Chinese context at the time, because, you know, focusing as I do very much on an emperor who had his own agenda, one also has to understand how things could work within, doing with the fact that he had to convince scholars who were of Chinese culture. So that's, I think, two points I'm trying to make, and I think in the last respect, I think this is where I tried to take literally the reference that the book title makes to Andersen's tale. Try to think of what kind of cloth were the emperor's new mathematics made of. And this is where I have tried also to say, what else can we say than the traditional story, which is not only that Western mathematics arrived in China, but the other side of the story, which is, what a pity that the Chinese did not make, you know, full profit of it. They could have done so much better. My alternative is to say, well, how can we account for what happened, rather than trying to understand why something else did not happen? So I hope that by the end of the book, I have brought the reader to agree with me that there was no such thing as, you know, science coming somewhere and establishing itself. and that we have, in fact, not one, but perhaps several reconstructions of mathematical knowledge in 18th century China.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I know it's a very rich book, and we didn't have time to get to probably even half, if that, of the contributions that the book is making. Is there anything else about the book that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to point out for listeners, especially those who may not yet have had the opportunity to read the book?
Yes, perhaps there's just one point I would like to make. I think I what mathematical subjects I would deal with. So as I said at the beginning of this discussion, I said I chose problems that I found before in the Chinese tradition, but I also made the choice to deal with mathematics that I believe everyone has learned at high school. But from me, this is also a plea, I think, addressed to historians to say, don't leave the history of science to, you know, people who have studied science. It's culture in human history, and it should really be integrated more thoroughly into historical narratives.
Great. And now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on the book, what are you working on now? What's your next project, or what's inspiring you at the moment?
Well, I suppose what is inspiring me is still related to circulation. In the last couple of years, I have been involved in coordinating a collective project. It's called Individual Itineraries and the Circulation of Scientific and Technical Knowledge in Late Imperial China. And we are looking on various case studies on how individuals' geographical mobility did or did not contribute to the circulation of knowledge. We start, of course, from the pattern of circulation of Chinese elites. So as I mentioned, for Mei Wending, you know, from your native town to the district prefecture, then to the provincial capital, then to the empire's capital, and then if you succeed, to a part of the empire that you've never been to before. But also if you fail, of course, you then go home and you also cause knowledge to circulate. So we are looking at scholar officials, but also at, for example, a monk architect. We are looking at medical practitioners. We're looking at various individuals related to the imperial court. We're also looking at foreigners who circulated in China in order to work towards, how far can we go in producing a cartography of knowledge? And so this involves not only, writing articles of books, but also involves collecting information in a database and trying to work with maps as well. Can one really map knowledge literally? You know, is it possible to survey either a particular field or a particular area of China, or just follow up a person's itinerary and see how the knowledge is, again, constructed and circulated as this person moves around the empire?
Great. Well, best of luck with that project, and thank you again for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much, and join us next time.